right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm not going to take a lot of time doing much of intros, except to tell you we got a hell of a show for you today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Robert Gardner. Who's Robert Gardner? He's a student at UCLA who was walking around a supermarket and looked at a poster on the wall outside the supermarket that said, "These are Jew haters," and it had his name down on it. And we're going to be listening to what the hell is going on with that, all right? What's behind that? Before that, we'll be talking with Felice Gellman. Felice is from the U.S. Friends of the Janine Freedom Theater. We're going to be talking about the public theater's decision back in May to cancel. They were pulling together an effort to stage a play called The Siege, which is all about a siege in the West Bank. And it was a very moving thing. It was about the tale of the Palestinian people and what's happening to them. And for some unknown reason, they decided, we're not going to run this. And it just reeks of a lot of other things that have happened around. Whenever people want to try and present the truth about the Palestinian people and what's going on, they are constantly facing all kinds of obstacles, including being shut down. So we're going to be talking with Felice Gellman about that. But opening the show up, all right, this is a hell of a thing because I kind of, you know, I've gotten into this routine where every year at this time, I expect to see this man sitting across the table from me. And it always brings great joy to my heart. It's Wayne Kramer, and he's one of the baddest. And I got to watch my mouth on this one, man. He's just one of the baddest musicians around. He's just and a great all-around person. Wayne, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. It's always a pleasure.
Sure, man. And just for people who've been living in a can for a long time, you know, they should know who you are. MC5 plus your own work that is, I mean, I'll tell you, and I know you're working with a friend of mine now on this film, Dave Zeiger, right? You're doing
yes,
the music for that.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's going to be an amazing film.
Yeah, but looking forward to it.
Yeah. Well, I remember sitting in the car with him, and I was just playing him. I had all these old albums of yours, these old CDs, and they were just driving me crazy. And the ones that had just a, you know, in case you've forgotten, okay, because the ones that had things like God's Worst Nightmare, which is one of my favorite songs. And, you know, I just really look forward to that. I spend a lot of time listening to your music because I find it's kind of the thing that gives me a lot of, same thing it did to me way back when in the 60s and whatnot, and what it does to me today in terms of just grabbing my heart and just, it starts at pumping and jumping out there.
Oh, thank you so much, man. Yeah. It's always, always good to know somebody's listening.
Well, and the breadth you have too, because I also really, as you know, you were on here when you put out your album Lexington, and I love that piece. You know, it's really, but again,
thank you.
You know, yeah,
thank you so much.
It's the breadth you have, but it's also the, you know, I'm sorry, I just came up in the same time period you came up in,
yeah.
And that music will forever drive me.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah,
me
there you
too.
Go. There you go.
I tell people that, you know, I mean, Lexington is in a lot of ways unorthodox and maybe new to many people's ears, but there's actually no new music on there. It's the same music I've been playing for 50 years,
You know, it's interesting because even in terms of the loud rock, I'll tell you just one experience, and then we'll get into talking about why you're here, because I used to have a convertible, okay, and it was a Saab, and I got a great deal on it. It was this old 92 Saab with a convertible. It looked like a boat, actually, uh-huh. Right? But it had the baddest sound system in it. And I would turn that thing up, and it would just rock the entire freeway. The other cars would be shaking when I'd be driving that. Yeah. But I loved it. Right? You put the top down, you got the music, imagine playing every MC5 album at top volume, and you're just bam, and you're driving. I got a ticket from a cop.
Love that. It.
He pulled me over, and he said, "Turn the music down." I said, "Why?" You know what?
Right.
And he gave me a ticket for disturbing the peace.
Oh, fantastic! I consider that a great honor.
Yeah, me too.
Hey, listen, all my music is designed to disturb the neighbors.
There you go. Exactly.
And the police,
and including right now, what you're going to do, and we're here. You're here to talk with us about Jail Guitar Doors, and this has been sort of developed into something I look forward to every year, is having you come in and talk about Jail Guitar Doors and what's going to go on. But first, tell people what that is.
Jail Guitar Doors. JGD is a 501c3 nonprofit founded 9 years ago by Billy Bragg, myself, and my wife, Margaret Kramer. And what we do is simple. We find people that work in corrections that are willing to use music as a tool for rehabilitation. And we provide them with instruments, mostly guitars, and we run songwriting workshop programs across the country in county jails. And we are in the process right now of launching JGD songwriting workshops in four California state prisons surrounding Los Angeles at Lancaster, Norco, Chino, and the California Institute for Women. We also have recently made inroads into the California Youth Authority, and we have a songwriting workshop up and rolling right now at Camp Gonzales. They call them camps. They're prisons right. for boys.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, my neighborhood, we had a lot of people went to camp for the summer.
Camp, yeah. So at this point, our instruments are in over 95 American prisons across the country, and we've got a waiting list of 50 more. And, things continue to move forward. There's a shift in the air. I'm a little skeptical about it, but there is a shift in the air. You know, the president is using his executive authority to try to commute some of these horrific sentences that people have endured. On the state level, there's a lot of, especially here in California, there's a lot of movement towards prison reform and justice reform. But I'm a little suspicious of a lot of it because a lot of it is organized by the Koch brothers. And what they do is it's a strategy that's aimed at the nons, nonviolent, non-serious, non-sex offenders. And they want to reduce sentences. They want to repurpose justice dollars. They want to work on reentry programs and rehabilitation programs for the nons. But what happens is every time the nons get a break, the other prisoners, who they consider the real bad people, violent offenders, they get jammed up worse. And you cannot paint all violent offenders with one brush. They're not instantly terrible people and that should be separated from the rest of us. A small percentage of them, absolutely. But in general, I'd put the percentage around 80%. So the bottom line with the Koch brothers' efforts, and they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on this, is they want to reduce penalties for white-collar crime, which is them. They are the worst polluters in American history. They've narrowly avoided going to prison themselves over the years, and all their efforts are designed to protect white-collar crime. So this is a slippery business here. So, anything that helps prisoners, I'm for, but this is a little tricky. And the worst aspect of the whole thing, I'll wrap this up, is that this entire apparatus of American punishment, no matter what reforms we engineer and we accomplish, ultimately what they're going to do is take this apparatus and shift it over to immigrants who have no rights. You and I have rights. We go to prison, we have the right to health care, we have habeas corpus, we have the right to First Amendment rights to talk to the press, to talk to our peeps. Immigrants have no rights. And that's business as usual for American punishment.
I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I'm talking today with Wayne Kramer, guitarist, part of the legendary rock band MC5, activist and co-founder of Jail Guitar Doors. And we're talking about music and the work of Jail Guitar Doors.
You know, it's very heavy because you think about this. It's also, you look at this thing about in terms of what's going on today, too, though. The fact that we can look at all the police murders that have come down and that very few have been prosecuted. You know, very, very few. I mean, you can count them probably on one hand. When there's a scare comes into the ruling class and they decide, okay, well, we have to make sacrifice somebody. But it's hardly anything at all right now. And in fact, people are being exonerated left and right. All these cops are being exonerated. And then you have the people still going to jail. While they're letting, there's some things in California where they're letting some prisoners out. But generally, overall, this doesn't seem to me to be a big, this is like, what were we doing all these years? We've been putting millions of people behind bars. What the hell's the matter with us? We better give them jobs and get them out there. It's like the mass incarceration is still a major plague on communities, especially of black and brown people. And this is something, and it's like you're saying, when you said, there's something you said in the material you put out around Jail Guitar Doors, you said the crime, you went to jail yourself.
Yep.
And you did what, a couple years, four years, something like that? Yeah.
I got a 4-year sentence. I did almost 3 years
right.
on it.
And it was for selling coke.
Yep.
And you made a comment which really kind of set me back. You said, if that was today, what I did then would get somebody life in prison.
Yeah, and there are people serving life terms for my same offense.
Right, exactly. So you think about that in terms of, look, mass incarceration is a fundamental part of this system in terms of, because they need, it's the way they exercise social control in a lot of ways. And they keep telling us people have choices, but you know as well as I do, man, people have different choices based on who they are, where they come from, the color of their skin, all of these things. There's, you know, you don't really have, choices are not something that's just sort of out in the air and you look up and say, you know, I don't like the idea of being like a great world-class scientist because it's just a little too much work. Where over here, I could just stick up this store and, you know, hey.
Yeah. We have choices in the kind of ice cream we want to buy.
Right. Yeah, there you go.
You know, we don't have choices on anything that matters.
There you go. Now, I wanted to, well, here's one of the things I wanted to actually get into with you, but I want to actually let people hear this song first, all right?
Sure.
So, Teddy, let's do track 5 and do your magic on making it possible to do that, all right? Because this is, you know, Wayne has been saying for quite some time now, he's been saying, and particularly this time around, you've been saying this thing about how do you deal with all this? Rock out. And I want people to hear this because this is the stuff that drove a lot of my younger life and still does today, all right? So check this out. As hard as it is to stop that, we've got to. But it's Wayne, I'm telling you, man, and that is a particular version of the song that I just was looking around this morning and I was looking for music I would play and then I thought, and I just stumbled onto this, just purely by accident, all right? And it's Kick Out the Jams, which is a classic MC5 song, classic You, and it's also got Bonorama in it.
Yeah, that was recorded live in New Orleans.
Damn, man.
Yeah. It was a great night.
Yeah.
Big fun.
I can imagine.
They're a great band. I mean, having four trombones playing that riff, you know, it was exciting.
Yeah.
You can hear it. I was having fun.
Yeah. No kidding. Listening to it is just like, in fact, this is going to be way up, and I have a story that is equally powerful to the one I had in the sobs. And now I can actually, no convertible, but I'll just throw all the windows open. Okay.
Good.
But this, we talked about what you thought about all this, but your point about what brought you to Jail Guitar Doors, that's very important for people to understand.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was released. I went to prison in the 70s and was released at the end of the 70s. And prison changes you, and I don't believe it changes anybody for the better. But one thing it did to me was make me acutely conscious of life in prison as it was for me and then as it was for everybody else. And so I would track stories, reports in the news, and I started to notice that, well, first, beginning with my time in the Federal Correctional Institution at Lexington, when I got there, the count was around 600 people. When I left, it was 1,200. So, you know, when I got there, we had day rooms, you know, and there'd be a piano and a TV, and we could, you know, have group in there, and guys could go in there if they weren't working. When I left, day rooms were done. They were all filled up with cubicles. It was looking like a state joint. And then I noticed over the years, as more and more people just like me went to prison for longer sentences under worse conditions, first tens of thousands, then hundreds of thousands, then millions. And today it's 2.3 million of our fellows under lock and key and another 10 million under direct state control. Parole, probation, ex-offenders. And as time went on, you know, I've been an activist all my life, and I started saying, wait a minute now, this isn't right, you know. This is morally rubbing me wrong, and when is somebody going to say something about this or do something about this? And nobody did. And it kept getting worse, and worse laws would pass, and prison building became the second biggest industry in California. I mean, we built, since 1980, we built 22 prisons and one college in California. And finally, you know, this builds a kind of nihilism up in me, you know, a kind of meaninglessness when I see unfairness and injustice happening on such a scale. And how do I militantly oppose that nihilism? And I've concluded the only thing I can do is take ethical action. And by ethical, I mean thoughts and actions that move in the direction of human happiness and move away from the direction of human suffering. Mm-hmm. What can I do? I'm a musician. I'm an ex-convict. Well, maybe I could play concerts in a prison. You know, when I was in prison, people came in and played. I played. It made a big difference for me. I organized a concert at Sing Sing, the infamous New York City maximum security facility, and took a load of my friends in with me, Tom Morello, Perry Farrell and his wife Eddie, Gilby Clark, Handsome Dick Manitoba, Don Was, Jerry Cantrell.
Didn't you also take Boots Riley in a couple times?
Boots was on that trip, yeah. And I took Billy Bragg with me. And we were standing around backstage talking, and he gets his guitar out, and his guitar says Jail Guitar Doors on it. And I said, what's up with that, Bill? The story, you know, when I went to prison, this new music emerged, punk rock. And The Clash, this great British punk rock band, wrote a song about me going to prison, me and a couple other guys. And at the time, I thought it was a great show of solidarity. You know, brothers from across the sea, I didn't know them, but were musicians. They highlighted my bad behavior in the song. I thought it was really terrific, and I didn't think anything else of it, you know. So here we are, fast forward 30 years. We're backstage at Sing Sing, and Billy has Jail Guitar Doors on his guitar. I said, what's up with that? He said, oh, it's an old Clash B-side. Have you ever heard it?
Who you calling a B-side, man?
I said, heard it. Bill, the song is about me. He said, what you mean? I said, what are the lyrics? Right. Let me tell you about wine and his deals of coke. Oh, bloody Manila. It is about you. I forgot. Oh, he was so embarrassed. And I love this man so much. I just adore him. So he started to explain to me that he wanted to do something to celebrate Joe Strummer's life's work. And a guy had written him from a British prison saying he was trying to use music to rehabilitate some drug addicts, but they had no guitars. Could Billy find him some guitars? Billy said, wow, this is exactly what I'm looking for to commemorate Joe's life's work. I'll name it after that Clash song, Jail Guitar Doors. I'll go get my rock star friends to give me some money, and I'll buy guitars, and we'll put them in the prisons. And I said, well, you know, I thought about it all day while we were playing, and the gig was a huge success, and it was really terrific. On the bus ride back, I said, Bill, what you're doing is great. You're British, and you're doing it in Her Majesty's prisons. But, you know, I'm an American ex-convict. I'm an American musician. I'm an activist. I'd like to take this on in this country. And he said, well, good. I'm glad you've decided that, because I was just about to task you with it. You're the only one that can do it because you've been inside. You know how the system works. So that was...
Well, you and Johnny Cash, okay.
Johnny actually didn't do any extended prison time. I mean, he spent the night in jail.
Right.
But in any event, that was the launch of JGD.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Wayne Kramer. He's a guitarist, part of the legendary rock band The MC5 from the 1960s, an activist and co-founder of Jail Guitar Doors. And we're talking about music and the work of Jail Guitar Doors. In this last part of the interview, we're talking about a benefit concert that's coming up in Los Angeles. Now, this is a concert, if you're living in another part of the country, you probably won't be able to make. But I thought it was important for people to understand what this is about and maybe get involved in your area. And if you want to get involved, you can go to jailguitardoors.org and find out how to get hold of them.
It's interesting because the first time that we did anything here about JGD was you had Billy Bragg come in with you. And it was great talking with the two of you. And I want people to know, you know, I've been to the last two. And was they the first two?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
And an amazing concert every time, including people that, just people that you don't expect to see, and the kind of surprises that come up, but also just the music that comes out. And you've brought people, both people that are very well known, but also people who aren't that well known, mm-hmm. but who still mm-hmm. are just like amazing in terms of what they're putting out. Right? Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about who's going to be there.
This year we have a great emerging band, the Wild Reeds, who are kind of NPR darlings. They did the Tiny Desk concerts uh-huh. and were received very well. Thrilled to have them. My dear sister, Jill Sobule, will be on stage. Jason Heath and the Greedy Souls. And Jason is a JGD facilitator. He runs a program at Camp Gonzales and is the lead facilitator in the Men's Central Jail, where we run our songwriting workshop. He's also going to take over some of the state prison workshops.
And his band is very, very
cool. Oh, they're terrific. Cool, they're terrific band. We have Gilby Clark is going to bring his band in and do a few songs. And my dear brother, Marshall Crenshaw, mm-hmm. is coming in from the East Coast. And, you know, he's one of my heroes. You know, every time I play with him, I get a guitar lesson because he's such a wicked guitar player. You know, people, they think of Marshall as a great singer and songwriter, but he's a wicked guitar player.
Wow.
He can really play.
Yeah.
I'll play with the Lexington Arts Ensemble. We have Keith Morris from the Circle Jerks Black Flag and Off. He's going to do some songs. And we have a couple JGD returned citizens, Frank Foster, who's performed on the show before. And this year we're going to feature Christopher Bisbano, who is a great guitarist that I met in one of the state prisons a few years ago, who used our guitars and did a terrific job inside and is now free, and he has agreed to come and play, and we're very excited about having him. Cody Marks, a JGD volunteer, is going to sing a couple songs, and we have Eleni Mandel, the great singer-songwriter, mm-hmm. who is also a JGD facilitator.
Wow.
So it's going to be a power-packed night. I'm trying to think if I'm forgetting anyone. I hope I'm not. Well, I think that's it. Yeah.
Is that all? Really? That's it? Come on, take a break, man. Anyway.
Oh, I know who I forgot. Don Was.
Ah, yeah. You know, the first time you were on my show, wasn't he on here with you?
He could have been, yeah.
Yeah. Because the two of you did a song.
Yeah.
Yeah, about, what's his name, the football player that was in Afghanistan.
What's his name, Tillis?
I can't remember, but it was a very moving song, and it was a great time with the two of you, man, and it was very deep.
Killed by friendly fire.
Right. And his parents were actually standing up and refusing to go along with the program, right?
Right.
So anyway, so that's another thing in terms of where the trail you've gone down, man, which is like a very, very important one. So Wayne, I know that you said, and I'd have to tell people the story because we don't have a lot of time, so I'm just going to put it, and you can, if you have anything you want to add, you can just throw it in real quick. But that point about rocking out, I have to tell people a story that I saw and what your publicist actually sent out in some of the news info around this, where you had helped Tom Morello and Prophets of Rage organize a concert at Norco Prison, Norco State Prison.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they got there, it was sort of canceled.
Yeah.
And so instead of turning around going, oh, damn, man, people going home, went over into a lot that was facing the wall, turned up the volume as loud as you could.
We set up on the street. There's a public street, and we set up. And you know, we managed to do it. My wife was genius at keeping the prison guards content, the local sheriff, the city manager, the local police, and us and the band, everybody calm. And we did the concert where we aimed the gear right through the fence where all the men in those housing units right there were rocking. Because
mm-hmm.
Tom said, you know, we promised to come here and play a concert and we want to live up to our, even if the Department of Corrections won't allow it, then, you know, they can't stop us. Right. And so we set up and the band rocked it. It was terrific.
And I bring that up because as we started this thing out with, what's the cure for all this? What do you got to do in the face of all this insanity and all this terrible oppression that's going on?
Take action.
and
ethical action
and rock out
and rock out.
There you go.
and I added on this in terms of this concert and our particular audience is to rock out and stay out.
There you go. Very good. Very good. All right, Wayne. Thanks again, man.
Thanks for having me, Michael. Sure. It's always a pleasure.
All right, and we're going to take a quick break and be right back. That's a piece from Gilad Asman called Janine. Right now, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Felice Gelman. Felice is from a group called the U.S. Friends of the Janine Freedom Theater. And she's coming on the show because a little while ago, I got an email that talked about the Freedom Theater in the Janine, basically refugee camp inside the West Bank. And I remembered years ago, I had had the director of the Janine Theater Company on the show. He was here visiting in the U.S. And since then, he was killed by a masked killer outside the Janine Theater in Janine. And there was a play that's been developed by the theater company. And the play is called The Siege. There was a promise from the, it wasn't official, but it was a promise and it was working on it, from the public theater in New York to run this play in this year, in 2016. And suddenly, out of nowhere, the play has been canceled. And the promise has been rescinded. And Felice is here to talk with us about this. Felice, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I appreciate you being available to be on and tell people what the hell is going on. So what's happening? What's the siege? Where's it come from? And what's it about?
Okay. Well, let's start with that. Just think back a little bit in history. In 2002, during the Second Intifada, the second uprising in Palestine, fighters sought sanctuary in the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Yes, and they were besieged by the Israeli army for 39 days. And it was a lengthy siege, and ultimately the eyes of the world were focused on this, I think partly because of the meaning of the Church of the Nativity, partly by the question of the issue of the nature of sanctuary at this time, and partly by that ongoing Palestinian struggle. So in any case, negotiations were held, and an agreement was reached with the Israeli army that the people who were in the church would be able to leave, but they would go into exile for 3 years. So they were 26 people were exiled to Gaza and the others to Europe in various places. They were split up in various places. So the Freedom Theater has a great tradition of both producing the works of other great playwrights that are relevant to Palestine's situation, but also writing their own pieces. And the artistic director of the Freedom Theater, Nabil El Rey, decided that he would write about the siege. And so the siege is a play that's based very much on the recollections and interviews that were done with the people who were there. And it takes you in a place that you never saw in 2002. It takes you inside the Church of the Nativity so that you can try to understand who were these people, what were they fighting for, how did they feel, how did they respond to the tremendous pressure of the siege itself, and how did they find themselves, how did they conduct themselves. This is... I think it's a very moving play. I've seen it in Janine, actually, and I'm very much looking forward to bringing it to the United States. And let me just say, we will bring it to the United States. We expect to bring it to the United States in the fall of 2017, and we're in the process of putting together that tour.
So what happened with the public theater in relation to this?
Well, you may have noticed, if you just look around you, that Palestinian voices are routinely silenced in the United States. So right now, the governor of California, I don't know if he's signed it yet or not, but he is looking at legislation to outlaw people who support boycott, divestment, and sanctions as a response to 68-year Israeli occupation. If you remember what happened to the Metropolitan Opera when they when they put on the opera about Klinghoffer.
The death of Klinghoffer.
Yes, the death of Klinghoffer. There were enormous protests and efforts to shut it down. So this is actually a routine. I don't think that if you remember MECCA, Middle East Children's Alliance in Berkeley, had an exhibit of children's art from Gaza, and they were forced to relocate it because it was described as terrorist art and the venue was taken away from them. So this is not a new phenomenon in the United States. There is an effort, a very well-financed and well-organized effort to silence Palestinian voices. And so now, but going back directly to the public theater, the only thing I can tell you about it is, I mean, I'm not inside the public theater. I can't say, you know, what went on there, but I can say that this was not an artistic issue. That I think it's fair to say, and they would say that as well, I think. This was not an artistic issue. It's a very, very, Palestinian voices, as I say, are regularly silenced. And this is the basis on which the occupation has sustained itself.
Mm-hmm.
If there is no debate about Palestine and Israel, it's described as a conflict, but it's not a conflict, it's an occupation. That's not even something that's even described in the paper. So the use of language, the use of the way in which the story is cast, the silencing of the story is a way to sustain the occupation.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, a lot of people might remember. Yeah, and a lot of people might remember very clearly the efforts that were raised against My Name is Rachel Corrie and Alan Rickman's production of that. And then it was actually shut down for a while. And it was and what a difference it's made in the world when it finally was able to bust through that. You know, I think that's extremely important. You know, we're running up against time, but I wanted you to let people know it's very heavy what the Freedom Theater actually is, because this was two things. One, this was not something that was just sort of an idea, the mounting of this play by the public theater. This was something that was actually in preparation. And while there wasn't a contract, it was in preparation. And there had been a year of work being put into doing this, which is very important.
There was a year of work.
Yeah.
There was a year of work. But as I say, we will bring this, I commit to you, we will bring this play to the United States, and it will be seen. It's very important to stand up against the silencing, and that really, I just can't say how important it is for people to do that. If I'm short on time, I do want to mention one thing, Michael, which mm-hmm. is that the Freedom Theater will be bringing a multimedia tour, which is its art and photography work, to the La Pena Cultural Center in Berkeley in the end of October 23rd. And I know that it's not a short distance to Berkeley, but I'm sure many of your listeners have friends up there. And if you'll keep an eye on La Pena's schedule, I'm sure you'll see it and can buy tickets and see the Freedom Theater for themselves.
Absolutely. And maybe people can figure out a way to bring it down here as well, because it would be really great. Okay.
We are always open to offers because we try to bring people from the Freedom Theater to do something in the United States, a theatrical production or a different kind of production, as we're doing right now every year.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want to round up some supporters in L.A., we would love to be there.
All right, Felice, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And hopefully we'll have you back soon to talk about how this unfolds and how it continues to develop across time. All right?
I hope so.
All right.
Thanks very much.
Sure. Thank you. Take care.
Okay.
All right, this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I've just been talking with Felice Gelman from the U.S. Friends of the Jenin Freedom Theater, which is based in the Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank of Palestine. And we've been talking about the decision earlier this year by the Public Theater in New York City to go back on an agreement to present the play The Siege in partnership with the Freedom Theater. As Felice pointed out, there is an organized, well-financed effort to prevent people in the U.S. from being able to take political action in support of the Palestinian people, and even from hearing or having access to Palestinian voices.
We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll hear from Robert Gardner, a student at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a member of Students for Justice in Palestine. Now, Rob has had some recent experience with the efforts to silence people who support Freedom for Palestine, so stay tuned.
Tales from the dark side, evidence of the settlements on my hard drive. Man, I swear my heart died at the end of that car ride. When I saw that checkpoint, welcome to apartheid. Soldiers wear military green at the checkpoint. Automatic guns, that's machine at the checkpoint. Tables not M16s at the checkpoint. Fingers on the trigger, you'll get leaned at the checkpoint. Little children, grown adults and teens at the checkpoint. All your papers better be clean at the checkpoint. Gotta put your finger on the screen at the checkpoint and pray that red light turns green at the checkpoint. And Martin Luther King had a dream of the checkpoint. He waked with loud screams from the scenes at the checkpoint. Is Malcolm X by any means at the checkpoint? Imagine if your daily routine was the checkpoint. And Martin Luther King had a dream.
All right, welcome back. That was just Siri X with Checkpoint. And now we're going to hear an interview I did earlier with Robert Gardner, a student at UCLA and a member of Students for Justice in Palestine.
As regular listeners of the show know, I've spent a lot of time really paying attention to the issue of Palestine and the Israeli settler occupation force that, you know, it's basically has been responsible for some of the most heinous crimes in recent times in terms of what they've done in Gaza, what's been going on with the Palestinian people. And there's always, whenever support steps up for the Palestinian people, no matter what level it's on, there's always a major smackdown coming from the Israeli regime. And it's a very intense thing, whether it's a university professor who's getting harassed for speaking the truth about what's going on there, or for calling on people to stand up in support of the Palestinian people, people who were reporting on the horrific fascistic assault on Gaza just over the last couple of years were constantly basically being harassed and targeted by people who were spreading things about them or questioning their right to even be on university campuses. And one of the big targets of this, especially important, that's come out over the last few years has been on university campuses, a lot of it centered in California for the moment, but also I'm sure spread throughout the country. The founding of groups like the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement, and Students for Justice in Palestine, and people who have joined them have found themselves being the target of various forces that want to basically haul them over the coals and, you know, attack the veracity of what they're saying about Palestine. And one of the ways that this has been expressed recently has been on the college campuses, taking aim at the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement and Students for Justice in Palestine. And this has been expressed by various supporters of the Israeli regime as the main way. They say the goal of all their campaign is to make the enemy pay and to send a message, a deterrent message, that actions taken by these groups, such as those that they engage in, will result in massive punishments. And they've said that this is the only way they can see to really stand up for Israel is by launching these massive attacks against what people who are standing with the Palestinian people are doing. A little while ago, I came across a news article that talked about a young man from UCLA who was walking down the street, stopped at a store, at a market, saw a poster up on the wall, and found himself named on the poster as a Jew hater. And I decided, we've got to find this guy and talk to him. And we did. And his name is Robert Gardner. He's a student at UCLA, and he's joining us today to talk about this. Rob, how are you?
Hey, how's it going?
Good, good. Tell people what exactly happened to you.
So, you know, one day I went to the market, and, you know, I was coming back out of the market, and I looked across the street, and I seen this really huge, gigantic poster. It was probably taller than me, and I seen a lot of people's name on it, and so I walked across the street, and I looked at it, and I seen my name on it, and it said that the following students are Jew haters and are aligned with terrorist organizations and support a genocidal campaign. I was pretty shocked. It was in public in Westwood for everybody to see. And then when I got to campus, when I looked on the actual campus, they were posted everywhere on the campus. They were posted in the newsstands, in the lunch areas, where people take classes. So it was really disturbing. And then not only that, but there were also other posters too. There are other posters with ISIS, and everything. So it was a really disturbing experience. At the same time, I also found out that I was on a blacklist website that's trying to prevent me from getting employed. And so all of this pretty much culminated in me starting to receive death threats. I started to receive death threats online. I had people, you know, just harass me and bullying me, you know, finding out my social media online and my email. So it was really disturbing. And I actually contemplated on ending my support for the Palestinian cause because I didn't think it was worth my safety. I don't want to sacrifice my safety and my mental health. But thankfully, because of the support system that I do have at UCLA, you know, I had a lot of support from my colleagues that I decided to go ahead and continue that activism. And so that's why I still do fight for Palestinian rights to this day.
Well, tell us something, Robert. Actually, one thing real quick. You said there were other posters, ISIS posters and this blacklist site. Tell us a little bit about each one of those. What the hell is the ISIS poster?
Right. So there are also posters posted with ISIS, and it'll say, "Students for Justice in Palestine support genocide, and we support terrorist organizations." So you have posters of ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and all of these, you know, other posters with so-called terrorists with weapons and everything and killing people and hanging people. So that was really disturbing. So in other words, they're trying to say that people like me, who is a, you know, anti-racist, anti-oppression, anti-colonial human rights activist, is somehow discriminatory and we're terrorists. We're aligned with terrorists, at least, and that, you know, we're anti-Semitic, you know, and we support genocide, which is completely spurious accusation. There's also a website up as well. So pretty much this website, it's a website where they post the names of student activists, primarily student activists, but also some professors too. And pretty much the website casts us as anti-Semitic, that we support terrorist organizations. The goal of this blacklist website is to prevent us from getting employed. If I want to work for a nonprofit, for example, if they Google my name and, you know, if they Google my name in my school, then this website will pop up and then they will think that I support terrorists, et cetera, then I wouldn't get hired. So because of our fight for human rights, they're trying to destroy my career. So, you know, it's very disturbing.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did you get involved in this? You said they basically accuse you of being a supporter of Palestine, of the Palestinian people, and you, in fact, are a supporter of the Palestinian people, but you have a particular way you got involved in this, which I thought was very interesting and important for people to know.
Right. The reason why I joined Students for Justice in Palestine is because it's a, you know, anti-racist, anti-oppression, anti-colonial human rights organization that supports equality and justice for all people. And as an African American, I was able to see the parallels between the Palestinian community and my community. So, for example, see the racialized state violence, right? So in Palestine, the people who are simply unarmed civilians protesting the occupation and the colonialism of their land, they're shot with rubber bullets, tear gas, and even live ammunition. You see the militarization of their lands. You see the armored vehicles, detention, political imprisonment. And you also see the same thing here in America, right? So you see this racialized state violence against Black Americans. We've seen it in Ferguson, in Baltimore, in Louisiana, where Black Americans were also shot with rubber bullets, and we were also shot with tear gas. You see the militarization of our communities, and you see the repression of our communities and the harassment of political activists. So you're able to make the connections. And not only that, but you also see the collaboration of racialized tactics between American police departments and the Israeli police department and the IDF. So the pro-Israel groups usually for free give the American police departments free trips to Israel, and they learn these racialized tactics, and then they use those same tactics and then come back and occupy our communities and oppress Black people. So that's how I was able to make the connection. But not only that, but of course other human rights abuses too, right? So like, for example, in the West Bank, according to the World Health Organization, the average Palestinian receives less water than what's recommended for the average human being, right? You see the segregation, segregated housing, just because of their race and ethnicity, they're not allowed to live in the illegal colonies. You see that they're not allowed to drive on the same roads. They have to live under a separate legal system. So something like akin to like racial caste, which kind of reminded me of, you know, Jim Crow and racial caste. So you see that, you know, even though our oppressions are not the same, like, for example, like anti-Black racism and anti-Palestinian racism are not the same, but you see that they're connected to the same systems and sources of oppression. So that's how, as an African American, I was able to make those connections and be a supporter for Palestinian human rights.
Mm-hmm. It's extremely important, actually, what you're saying.
Let me remind listeners that this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Robert Gardner, a student at UCLA and a member of Students for Justice in Palestine. And we're talking about a campaign of organized and well-financed attacks on people who dare to stand with the Palestinian people here in this country, especially on college campuses.
You know, tell me something. Did you hear about the who was behind this poster and this whole campaign that's being launched on the campuses across the country, specifically right now on the California campuses, with plans to spread to, I've read somewhere that it has plans to spread to 20 more college campuses this fall. Did you read anything about the forces behind this? Do you know anything about the forces behind this?
Right. So the organization behind the posters was the David Horowitz Freedom Center, which, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, is a anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant, and anti-Black hate group. And the Horowitz Center is the one that posted these posters up. But another caveat is that the Campus Maccabee Task Force, which is an organization that is funded by Sheldon Adelson, who is a right-wing casino tycoon. He's a billionaire. And he and his allies have funded the Maccabee Task Force upwards to $50 million just to fight us on campus. And the Maccabee Task Force gave the David Horowitz Freedom Center, which is a hate group, they gave them grant money to help fund their campaigns. And the David Horowitz Freedom Center is the center that put up the posters. So it's very disturbing that the Maccabee Task Force would fund such a hate organization that is anti-Muslim, that is anti-immigrant and anti-Black, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. And if you look at their website, I think it's pretty obvious, you know. So I have to ask myself, if the Maccabee Task Force, what kind of messaging do they plan on disseminating across college campuses in America? What else are they going to fund if they're willing to fund a hate organization?
Mm-hmm. You know, this thing with Horowitz is it's very, very heavy. It's very serious because Horowitz is, you know, he's somebody who was at one point in his life was involved in the protests of the 60s. He was involved in Ramparts magazine, and then he became extremely reactionary. He became a fascist. He went out preaching against communist movements, against revolutions, against, you know, struggles of Black people, struggles of anyone standing up against this system. And he was often featured on the college campuses. In fact, at UCLA, I know he spoke at least once and probably more than that, and was represented as someone who has a legitimate viewpoint around the state of affairs in the country. And he was constantly building up to attack progressive people and what they were doing. And he has been in the ring for a long time in support of all of these various fascist regimes, including the Israeli regime. So this is not a person who's new to what's going on in this, or a person who's new to this whole kind of fascistic assault that sort of plays along with what the U.S. is doing in relation to the region and the world itself, too.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, tell me, the UC campuses and campuses in California have been a particular target of this. It's kind of interesting to me, and what I was reading about this, there's a lot of reports that say that they're going to concentrate on the campuses in California, and they've been concentrating them on them, and that Horowitz himself is targeting a lot of the campuses in California with plans to go way beyond that and starting with going reaching 20 campuses in other parts of the country as well. Can you tell people a little bit about what has been happening on the UC campuses and at UCLA in particular?
Right. So there's a reason that they are focusing on the University of California campus system. So as you may know, 8 out of the 9 UC campuses have supported divestment from Israel's human rights abuses against the Palestinians. So 8 out of 9. So as you can see, that is an abundance of support at the University of California system, especially because of communities of color, especially. So pretty much what you see is called the intersectionality of struggles. And what the intersectionality of struggles means is that even though our oppression may not be the same, our oppressions are connected to the same systems and sources of power, such as racism, such as American imperialism and colonialism, right? And so what we're doing is that we're coming together, and we're coming together in solidarity and realizing that we need to alleviate our oppression together. And so that's why you see so much solidarity with the Palestinian people. It has support from African-American students, Latino-Latina students, Asian students, etc. So you have this diverse coalition of students, even feminist students, queer students. So there's a really strong alliance for the Palestinian people. And so that's why you have people like David Horowitz and the Maccabee Task Force. They're very concerned, and that's why California is the eye on the prize for them, is the main target, because you see so much support on campus. So we're definitely preparing for it, even though we're very concerned, including for our safety, because, like I said again, the Maccabee Task Force is funding a hate group, so I have to ask, what else are they going to fund? But the reason why they're going this far is because they are concerned about the solidarity that we have from pretty much a diverse group of students that's growing.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about this new group called Movement for Black Lives and its relationship to Palestine.
Right. So the Movement for Black Lives is an organization composed of about 50 black organizations, including Black Lives Matter. And so what the Movement for Black Lives stated is that the Palestinian people are suffering from genocide and they are suffering from apartheid. And instead of the America subsidizing Israel's genocide and apartheid against the Palestinian people, that America should take that $3 billion a year that we give to Israel and reroute it to black communities. So, of course, the Member for Black Lives, they have faced a lot of backlash, especially from Zionist organizations. They've said that they're going to completely disavow the Movement for Black Lives platform, that they won't support us anymore, which is very telling that you wouldn't support African Americans. But pretty much they want black people pretty much not to support the Palestinian people, and they're very concerned because if African Americans support the Palestinian people and it grows and becomes ubiquitous around the country, then they're going to be in trouble. And so they see us as a threat. But Members for Black Lives, we're definitely not deterred. We've actually doubled down on our support for the Palestinian people. But obviously, like I said, you know, they're starting to attack the black organizations. Like we've seen this in Florida where they're attacking, I forgot his name, but he's an African-American running for the Senate. They're attacking him. They're attacking, you know, other African-American professors and politicians around the country that support Palestinian human rights. But like I said, you know, the Movement for Black Lives, we support the Palestinian people because we see the connections between the Palestinian community and the African-American community here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. All right, Rob, one more question. Where to from here? In terms of you're going back to school very soon, what can people expect? And in particular, I remember last, you know, was it a year ago that there was that whole big thing around the Regents and the attempt to actually condemn as anti-Semitic all the people that were supporting the Palestinian people, and they actually made some gain, but not the gain that they wanted to make. What do you see shaping up on the campus as it comes towards the opening days?
What I see is a growing of support. You know, obviously, we are still pushing for divestment now that 8 out of the 9 UCs have passed divestment. Our next campaign is to the Regents. So we want the Regents to divest from corporations that are profiting from human rights abuses. And we also plan to divest in conjunction with other divestment movements, such as divesting from the border and divesting from fossil fuels and divesting from the prison industrial complex that disproportionately imprisons African Americans. So we plan on pushing for divestment together because these same companies that are committing human rights abuses in Palestine are also committing human rights abuses against people of color in the United States as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we definitely plan on pushing for the divestment. We're not going to let trying to redefine our activities as anti-Semitic to stop us.
Mm-hmm. Now, one more thing. Where can people go to find out more about this movement? If they want to bring it to their campus, who can they hook up with to find out how to do that?
Well, SJP, you know, like there's really, if anyone wants to start a pro-Palestinian movement on campus, they can easily go to their respective institution and start one. Anybody can start a club. If you want to find out more about Students for Justice in Palestine, we have a Students for Justice in Palestine National at UCLA. We have our own website. It's www.sjpbruins.com. There's definitely a lot people can do with just about taking the initiative and starting your own movement on campus.
All right, Rob, thank you very much for joining us today. And definitely stay in touch when things develop, all right?
All right, thanks a lot.
All right, and take care of yourself, man.
All right, thank you.
Bye now.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I've been talking with Robert Gardner, a student at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a member of Students for Justice in Palestine. We've been talking about the high-level campaign against Students for Justice in Palestine and the BDS movement, the movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions aimed at the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land. And the website where you can find out more about Students for Justice in Palestine, SJP, is nationalsjp.org. All right, once again, that's nationalsjp.org. I also want to thank Wayne Kramer from Jail Guitar Doors. And if you want to contact them, they're on Facebook or at jailguitardoors.org. And I also want to thank Felice Gelman from the U.S. Friends of the Janine Freedom Theater. And you can check them out at thefreedomtheater.org. And that's T-H-E-A-T-R-E, okay, thefreedomtheater.org. Or again, on Facebook. Or look on my Facebook page and I will post the links. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Jeff Pryor and Matt Kwiklinski, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Like me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter. All right, we're going to go out now with Mohammed's Radio from Warren Zevon. Talk to you again next week.
Everybody's restless and they got no place to go. Someone's always trying to tell them something they already know. So their anger and resentment flow, but don't it make you want to rock and roll all night long? Mohammed's Radio. I heard somebody singing sweet soulful on the radio. Mohammed's Radio. You know the sheriff's got his problems too. He will surely take them out on you. In walks the village idiot, and his face is all aglow. He's been up all night listening to Mohammed's Radio. Don't it make you want to rock and roll all night long? Mohammed's Radio. I heard somebody singing sweet and soulful on the radio. Mohammed's Radio. Everybody's desperate, trying to make ends meet. Work all day, still can't pay the price of gasoline and meat. Alas, their lives are incomplete. Don't it make you want to rock and roll all night long? Mohammed's Radio. I heard somebody singing sweet and soulful on the radio. Mohammed's Radio. You've been up all night listening for his trumpet, hoping that the righteous might just come.
Just be right.
I heard the general whispering to his aide-de-camp, be watchful.